Case number 09-7036. Monica Brooks and Tracy Taylor, on behalf of themselves and all other similarly situated appellants, Renee Marva Abel et al. Versus District Hospital Partners, LP, doing business as George Washington University Hospital. Mr. Saul for the appellants, Ms. Goldstein for the amicus curiae, and Ms. King for the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Morning, Counsel.
Micah Saub, joined by Dr. Mary Koontz for the appellants. Your Honors, the charge of discrimination that was filed by Renee Marable and her co-workers gave notice to the hospital and an opportunity to conciliate regarding the exact same dispute which Ms. Brooks and Ms. Taylor are bringing.
I want to make sure that I do understand the issue in the case. Are they similarly situated to the person who had filed? I understand. I'm trying to avoid using the word class because I don't want to get into the term of art for class actions, but are they the same category of plaintiff or complainant?
Well, Your Honor, the phrase...
They were outsiders applying for the job, right?
Yes.
And the person who filed, person or persons, was an insider applying for a new position.
Right. The insiders, they are similarly situated because the insiders who filed said to the EEOC, we object to the fact that we're required to take a test that discriminates on the basis of race. Now, they did not believe at the time they filed their charge that external applicants also had to take that same discriminating test. The EEOC quickly learned, because the defendants advised them of that, that everybody had to take the test. So in that regard, yes, they are similarly situated.
A bit troubling that it's only post hoc that we're able to tell that they are in some relevant sense similarly situated. The single filing rule is well established. I realize there's nothing can be done about that, but the norm under the law is that you have to file in order to have litigation status on a discrimination complaint, right?
Yes.
And the single filing rule is an exception to that norm.
Yes, sir.
Now, the question that comes to us today, as I understand it, is how far does that exception extend? Certainly it would extend to some other nursing assistant or whatever their prior title was within the institution, but whether it extends to somebody not identically situated or not is something that gives me some concern about how we would write our presidential opinion on that if we wrote one.
Well, I can understand that, Your Honor.
Can you give me some guidance on that?
Yes, of course, Your Honor. I think what's important in this case is that the let me step back and say that every case that this court has decided on single filing rule, starting with Foster v. Geary, has made it very clear that the factors that the court should be concerned with are notice to the defendant of the specific allegations raised by the non-filing party, and whether there's been an opportunity to conciliate. Now, there are lots of circumstances where courts might be concerned about whether we're going too far in permitting claims that we shouldn't permit. But if we think about those two factors, we realize that those really are a stopgap. If, for example, there's a multinational company, and somebody in California files a charge of discrimination, and somebody in Connecticut wants to rely on that charge, I think it is highly unlikely that the employer had notice of the Connecticut plaintiff's complaint. So if we follow the guidance provided in Foster, looking at notice and the opportunity to conciliate, then we have constrained the rule so that it doesn't go too far. Now, in this case, very quickly in the EEOC investigation, the employer said everybody has to take the same screening test. and they provided information about the external applicants. In fact, they provided test results for Monica Brooks herself. Ms. Taylor applied later on, so she wasn't within the scope of the EEOC investigation. But the EEOC investigation clearly encompassed the allegations of the interveners. In that regard, there's no question.
Frankly,
but that they
what
were.
Bothers me about the single filing rule to begin with is the opportunity to conciliate. The incentives to conciliate might be very different if you required everybody who's going to make a claim to do the same kind of filing that the statute seems to require. But creating the exception, you may have an employer who knows there's one complaining employee, which would be much more likely to be dismissive as to that claim than if they had 10 complaining employees. So I'm troubled by the single filing exception to begin with, but that's the law of the circuit. That's the way it is. But to extend it further to say that if you have differently situated complainants who also can piggyback, that runs the danger of further increasing the or decreasing the incentive to conciliate, doesn't it?
I don't believe so. And I want to say, Your Honor, that I don't believe that this case would in any way extend the margins of the rule. But I don't think that it decreases the interest in conciliation, because if the employer is aware, as is clearly true here, of the full scope of the complaint, which is to say that everybody who took the screening test was affected by it, and the employer was an active participant, they did a validation study that separately looked at the internal and the external applicants, okay? So they had every knowledge of what was going on. There's plenty of opportunity for everybody to conciliate at this point. Extending the single filing rule doesn't in any way change the interest in conciliation. If anything, it probably increases the likelihood that cases are conciliated, because those other plaintiffs who aren't present before the EEOC on day one are included. The stakes are higher. Everybody's going to care that much more about getting the case resolved.
My point was that without the single filing exception, the stakes would be on the table. Everybody would know how great the stakes were. With the single filing exception, it's well into the process before the employer may realize how great the stakes are.
Well, that wasn't true here, and actually that's
and
always the
I'm still concerned with the fact that we don't write for one case, though. We write...
Yes, I understand that, Your Honor. And it may be that the somewhat unique procedural posture of this case makes it a little bit different.
It's a little different, all right.
Yeah, can I ask about the unique procedural posture of this
case?
Because I had some trouble following it. Is it your position that the result of the district court's reaction to your 42B motion was that this case was severed or bifurcated?
Can I say yes, Your Honor?
Yeah. And doesn't that have something to do with the single filing rule?
Well, I think the second question, the answer is no. The defendant spends a page of their brief talking about the fact that a case must be severed in order to permit a 54B certification, in order to allow us to get here. The fact is, it doesn't matter whether the case is severed or bifurcated. Because
doesn't it matter for the single filing rule, for the vicarious exhaustion? If you have two separate cases here, I don't know of any authority that says plaintiffs in one case can take advantage of the filing for the EEOC of plaintiffs in another case, right?
Number one, Your Honor, there are at least two circuits that have gone that way. Mm-hmm. Tolliver in the Second Circuit and Callaway in the 11th Circuit. There may be others that I can't name at the moment. Those circuits, by the way, have been concerned with the exact same issues that this court has always been concerned with, which is whether the underlying purposes for the charge filing requirement have been met. All right? So we would just be consistent. Likewise, this court held in the Laffey case that it doesn't really matter who notifies the employer of the charge as long as the employer is notified. So deciding this case in favor of the plaintiffs is consistent with not only...
It isn't your case made stronger by the following procedural argument, that bifurcation occurred here. They're still plaintiffs in the same case.
It is, Your Honor. And for that matter, there is this dispute as to whether it's bifurcated or severed.
It was called a Rule 42B motion, right?
Yes, and
what is Rule 42B?
That is bifurcation, not severing.
It walks
I'd
like
also
a duck.
Like to point
if it
out,
talks
Your Honor,
like a duck, you know, maybe it's a duck, right?
Well, we would be happy to accept that, Your Honor. Does
that affect your certification for immediate appellate review if we did?
No, it doesn't. Because certification, 54B, does not require a severing. And the defendant argued at length that it does, but I'd like to bring this court's attention to Gaffney versus Riverboat Services, 451 F3rd 424. At footnote 17, this court held, and this was the first case on which the defendant relied, that severing does not affect 54B certification. In fact, the fundamental purpose of 54B is to permit part of a case to go on when they haven't been severed.
Stronger argument for bifurcation, isn't it?
I mean,
Yes. I see that I've exceeded my time, Your Honors.
Did you have another question?
No, I was just trying to figure out, because it seemed to me that you had been arguing that it was severed under 21.
Mm-hmm. That puzzled
and
me.
And I had a question about that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor.
21, you want to...
Well, Your Honor,
I was going with 42. You want to double down from 21 to 42?
I think. Can you just rip out pages 23? I think Judge Griffith, that you're correct. That our case is stronger if we take the position that it was bifurcated and not severed. We know from Gaffney and other cases that we don't need severance for our 54B certification. And there's one other point that I'd like to make, if I could just be indulged for a moment.
Okay.
You keep saying Judge Griffith is correct, and you can go as long as... Although, no, Judge Santel gets to decide that.
When a case has been exhausted, that means that the employer has received notice and an opportunity to conciliate. The position that the defendant takes essentially is that even if it were severed, that somehow it became unexhausted. And that's simply illogical. Unless they can convince this court that as a result of the severing or anything that's happened in this case...
That's not really new. So your time is up. So
yes, Your Honor.
My colleagues have more questions.
Thank you.
We will likely give you back a little time for rebuttal if you need it.
That's very nice. Thank you, Your Honor.
That's not a promise. That's just a forecast. Okay, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Jennifer Goldstein, counsel for the EEOC, amicus curiae in this case. I'd like to start by addressing some of the questions you asked, Judge Santel. It is the EEOC's view that the district court was correct in its first ruling at the intervention stage that when it held that Brooks and Taylor had vicariously exhausted because their claims were so similar to those of the Marable Group. Now,
is there a case that's close to being on point that goes either way on that, either for you or against you on that question?
I would say that there are many cases in which this is actually more similar in many ways, that the two groups are more similar than many of the cases that we cited, say even in the Foster case where you had union members versus non-union members. I think the factors that are critical here are the fact that the Brooks group was seeking the same job in the same location as the Marable Group. They were challenging the same test that was given in the same time frame that the Marable charge challenged. And they were challenging the test on the same basis, namely, as Marable, namely that it had a disparate impact on the basis of race. These are extremely similar claims. And I think given these similarities, any EEOC investigator absolutely should have included all the applicants within the scope of an investigation. And of course, in fact, in this case, the EEOC investigator did. I would like to address the incentive question that you asked as well. You asked what the employer might do. Just to explain the EEOC process a little bit, when an investigator gets a case and decides to investigate, they sit down with their supervisor and perhaps lawyers as well and decide the scope of the investigation. And they are supposed to, and then they send a letter to the defendant explaining the scope and also explain that the scope may be expanded. So it's a careful consideration, and I think
That's boilerplate when they tell you the scope may be expanded, unless things have changed a lot in the last 22 years. No matter what the facts are, it's going to say that.
Well, it may, but I think that put, and in fact, in this case, it, and I think, but I think that's important because in this case, it was expanded, because the investigator received for the initial, charge filers didn't know that the test was given to external applicants. So I think it's not insignificant. And so I think
well,
that
it is significant or possibly significant as to what notice the employer is on as to the scope of the charge. You would agree that single filing is an exception to the normal rule.
Yes, it is.
The normal rule is you have to file if you're going to get relief.
Right.
This is an exception.
But it's a long established, well settled exception.
Yeah, but the
exception.
Question is the breadth of the exception.
Mm-hmm. Of course, and in this case, it is so.
And you
similar.
Would agree that there could be claimants sufficiently dissimilar
of
that
course.
It would not apply, right?
Oh, of course. I think the point, one critical point, is that there is nothing that a second charge would have accomplished in this case. There's no the investigation already had encompassed them, and frankly, I didn't see anything in the defendant's brief that suggested what a second charge might have accomplished. And so we think it would be, to quote the Otis court, I think, it would be wasteful to require a second charge in a case like this one, where it's so similar. I would also like to address, I think Judge...
Address quickly, because
oh, I'm sorry.
You are an intervener, and yet you're already over time.
Okay, sir. You know, then I will simply say that, Judge Griffith, in answer to your question about the severance or bifurcated, that's right, initially it wasn't severed. They were part of the same claim. After it was severed, I would just add to the Callaway and Tolliver case sites, the Wheeler case, which this court in Foster relied on. Wheeler was a Fifth Circuit case, though. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Alicia King on behalf of Appalese, or the Appalee District Hospital Partners. Your Honors, on both issues that are presented in this appeal, the jurisdiction question and the failure to exhaust, the appellants have asked this Court to go beyond the limits of the rules, the statutory provisions, and the well-established case law that applies here. The hospital has two primary arguments. One, that there really isn't proper jurisdiction for this appeal, given the unique procedural history that brought us here. And our second argument is that there really is no legal support or factual support for extending the single filing rule to the extent that they are asking you to do. I'll address those arguments in order unless the Court prefers otherwise.
Do either of you wish to hear about the jurisdictional argument?
I don't.
If you do, we'll go ahead and hear about the jurisdictional argument.
Is that a yes?
Go ahead. Go ahead on the jurisdictional argument.
I'll just touch on it briefly. What's important here is that the context of the decision that they are appealing is a motion for class certification. And in the context of that decision, the district court said to them, the two people that you're proposing to be named class representatives have not exhausted their administrative remedies so that they may not serve as class representatives. If the appellants wanted to seek appellate review of that decision, what they should have done or could have done is ask the district court to certify it under Rule 54B. And both parties would have had an opportunity to argue at the district court level as to whether that decision in the context of class certification was properly appealable. We would have argued that it was not appealable at that stage. And there's a case of this circuit, In re James, cited at 444 F3rd 643, which would have supported our position. Instead of doing it that way, they went through all of these procedural maneuvers. They moved to sever the claims of Brooks and Taylor, and in so doing, they said to the district court, Brooks and Taylor no longer have a viable claim. There's no case or controversy that applies to Brooks and Taylor's claims. Well, the district court had not at that point concluded that. The district court had let those two into the case as interveners and allowed them to be individual plaintiffs. The district court had only said at that stage, they cannot be class representatives. But what they did to try to get around the whole argument about whether the class certification decision was appealable, they moved to sever. They tell the district court there's no viable claim anymore. The district court has no choice but to dismiss them. And then they come up to this court by doing this procedural circumvention of the normal process. And our position is that that was not proper, that they're, in fact, putting a decision before you today that really isn't, is premature.
What's lacking for a certifiable final partial?
You mean if they had, yeah. If they had.
What is lacking?
What is lacking?
Yeah, a partial decision can be appealed if you have the 54B certification.
Correct, yeah. But there is law.
What's lacking for certification?
Well, there's precedent in this circuit that a failure to exhaust is not immediately appealable. And part of the reason for that is that there are still issues that are.
Didn't the court say he was dismissing as to these plaintiffs, that it was a final judgment on these disputes?
Yes, but that's because of the maneuvers that they did,
well,
which
it may
was
be,
to
but
sever.
Nonetheless, it was, yeah, a final decision as to these plaintiffs.
Well, that's true, Your Honor, but what he said was a final decision was the dismissal of them. Mm-hmm. And what we would say is at the time they were dismissed, they were still individual plaintiffs. But what they're saying to you now is take a look at the class certification decision. I'm sorry.
Didn't he go ahead and dismiss their claims?
He dismissed their claims as individual plaintiffs.
They're in them waiting to appeal after the decision as to the other plaintiffs.
What they're appealing right now, if they were just appealing that dismissal, then I would agree it's ready for appeal. But the arguments that they're making to you are not just the dismissal of those two, it's their ability to serve as class representatives.
Can't we reverse this to the dismissal without deciding the question of their class representative status?
Yes.
All right. Right.
Except that's not any of the arguments that are before you, though. The arguments. I mean, what they're trying to say is when the district court made a decision about us, he said we can't be class representatives because we can't rely on Marable's charge. That decision came in the context of class certification.
We'll wait to hear from them, but I thought their argument, where they were just pointing out that there seemed to be some inconsistency in the reasoning of the district court in the two separate decisions.
Right.
One about class certification and then the other on the dismissal. It seemed to use different.
That's not correct, though. Okay. I mean, that is what they're saying. It's not correct. What the district court did was it allowed these two to intervene and at that time said, we're going to allow you to rely on Marable's charge. They're still in the case. Yep. Then later they said, we want to become class representatives. Now the district court says, well, when I'm looking at you and whether you can be a class representative, now I have to see whether anyone in the class has filed a charge. You two are not able to serve as class representatives. He didn't kick them out of the case, though. He did not say.
But he did ultimately dismiss their claim.
Only because after that decision, the plaintiff's counsel then said.
This will be a yes or no. He did
ultimately
dismiss their claims,
that.
Right?
Yes, yes.
And they are appealing that dismissal, are they not?
Well, it's unclear.
That's a yes or no, too, I think.
I don't think I can say yes or no to that. They're appealing the dismissal, but the rationale for it is different. It's the rationale for their appeal relates to the decision about class representatives, not just the dismissal. I'd be interested to know what they say.
I don't see why you think we can't decide the dismissal question without deciding the class representative question.
You could. If you were to say they should have dismissed.
Once you say we could,
yes.
Don't we have jurisdiction to do that?
For that limited scope of review, yes.
Okay.
Okay, sorry. Okay, I'm going to move on to their attempt to have this court extend the single filing rule. What they are asking for now is for this court to allow a claimant to rely on the charge of another person when no member of the proposed class has ever filed a charge, the class they propose to represent specifically excludes the charge filer, and when according to their interpretation of severance, they're in a totally different action. There's no support for that.
If we decide only the viability of their individual claims,
correct.
What then is your argument on the single filing exception?
Okay. Then I would go to the facts of what happened here and what both the EEOC and the appellant's counsel have represented to this court about the EEOC file is not borne out by the file itself. If you look at the EEOC file, what the charging party alleged and what the EEOC was investigating. They were investigating a claim of discrimination by one nursing assistant who failed to pass a training course. At that time, this nursing assistant and the other women that she was with were actually adverse to the external applicants. The nursing assistants were saying, the hospital is applying this test and allowing other people to come in from the outside and take our jobs. Yes, in the investigation, the EEOC did consider who passed this test and at what rate, but the reason they did that was to consider the validity of the test overall and to see whether, in fact, other groups were being benefited. So, for example, the EEOC looked at Hispanics, they looked at Asians, they considered men versus women. What they are essentially arguing is that anything that the EEOC looked at is then fair game, and any of those groups can file a charge or can rely on the charge that was filed. The agency was never looking at external applicants as in an effort to, you know, make sure that their rights were being protected. The EEOC was looking at external applicants and men and Hispanics to see whether the nursing assistants had been discriminated against. And what they're asking you to do is basically say, well, if the EEOC comes in and they look at white men and black women and, you know, Hispanic women, anything that they look at is then properly something that a future discrimination plaintiff can rely upon. And it's important to actually look at the file. The other point I would go to finally is conciliation, because the fact that the nursing assistants...
Go quickly.
Okay. The nursing assistants had these jobs. The external applicants were the ones coming in to take those jobs away. Those two groups did not have the same interests in terms of conciliation. Thank you.
Unless there's questions then, we'll give 2 minutes back to the appellant for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, first of all, the defendant says that no member of the class has filed the charge, as if that matters.
Well, Foster, it may matter. You're asking for two kinds of relief. You're asking for reverse the district court's dismissal of their cause of action. It will not matter as to that one. You also asked to remand the case to the district court for further consideration of the plaintiff's motion for class certification. It could matter for that one.
Your Honor, Foster was not a class action. There has never been a requirement in this circuit or, for that matter, any circuit.
So you are asking us to remand on the class certification question?
Well,
procedurally, did you bring that before us under 54B? Counsel has a very good argument on jurisdiction as to the class certification.
I don't think so, Your Honor, and here's why. In Wagner versus Taylor, which we cited page 9 of our brief, this court held that this court has jurisdiction to hear issues that are not appealed when they're inextricably linked. Now, the order dismissing our clients was a one-line order. So if we want to know what the court was deciding, we've got to look somewhere else. Now, as it turns out, the court issued a show cause order before dismissing the case, and we responded and said, Judge Kennedy, you should not dismiss, and here's why, and we laid out the same reasoning. So we don't have to look at our motion for class certification or the response or the order on that. If we simply look at our response to the show cause and the fact that the court rejected that, we know what the court was doing. So we don't have to go to that other order, but even if we want to.
What was the inextricably linked case that you cited?
I beg your pardon?
What was the inextricably linked case that you cited?
It's not a case, it's an issue. It's an order, the order on class certification, which
right.
did not address class certification.
A moment ago when I was asking you about whether we had jurisdiction or not, I thought you cited a case saying that this court had held that we had jurisdiction.
Yes, in Wagner versus Taylor.
That's the case I'm asking you about. Yeah. Now, was that a 54B certification, or was that a certified question case? It may not matter.
I cannot recall, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
I know in Philip Morris we did hold the inextricable linking. But that was not 54B. That was don't have the citation in my mind, but the statute under which we can call up questions.
I think it's also worth noting, Your Honor, that the defendant is drawing a distinction where one doesn't actually exist. If you look at the decisions in this case, whether the response to our show cause or the actual narrative, the memorandum order in dealing with exhaustion, the trial court said that these women have not exhausted and they cannot rely on the single filing rule. That is the opposite of what the court had held 1 year earlier. This court decided the exact same issue twice. And throwing this notion of consistency, this notion of the rule of the case out the window, the court just re-decided the issue. There's not a distinction.
There is a lot of law that says law of the case doctrine is a very weak doctrine, Counsel.
Well, we didn't rely on that.
Okay.
We point that inconsistency out to this court because
the Fourth Circuit once told me I should have gone back and changed a ruling when I was a district judge.
I'm sure your ruling was correct, Your Honor. If the court has no other questions, we appreciate the court's time.
Thank you, Counsel. The case is submitted.